Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi. Welcome to another episode of Lob Podcast from These Football Times. I'm Gary Thacker, and with the European Championships on the horizon for the summer, across the coming weeks, I'll be chatting for half an hour or so with a number of members of the TFT team as they recount their memories of past championships and look forward to the 2024 tournament. Today, we start this mini-series with a technical wizard of the team, the man whose editing skills transform our mumbling and incoherent utterances into the podcast that you hear. Welcome, Dave Bowler.
Well, that's very kind. I don't know if I'd go quite so far, but that's very kind of you anyway, Gary.
So let's kick off the series, mate, and let's hopefully we'll get as coherent as possible to not give you too much work on this one to do on the editing front. Kick us off with your first memory of the past European Championships, buddy.
It literally is my first memory of the European Championships. Going back to 1972, the quarterfinal, England-West Germany, particularly the Wembley game, which... I suppose, it was the beginning of the end for Alf Ramsey, wasn't it? I mean, England lost 3-1. They only lost to two late goals, as it turned out. But, I mean, it was a game where they were outclassed. I mean, it was a Hungary 1953 game, that kind of thing. It was one of those seismic moments, I think, in English football history. And you know, I think it was the thing that really brought the European Championship to people's attention, because it had been a sort of a small time competition in a way, I suppose, before that. But this with West Germany, of course, with all the history and all of that going on, I think this was the one that really brought it to the nation's attention. And it was one of those rare games that was live on television back in 1972. So, I mean, you know, you'd got to watch it anyway, because it was, you know, how many games did you get live on telly in those days? 3, 4, 5, whatever it was in a season. So you'd got to watch it. And we ended up watching England being dismantled. So there you go.
Yeah, I remember too. I mean, I remember it being sort of, not advertised, but sort of mentioned in the press that this was the revenge game for the elimination of the World Cup in 1970. But, you know, as you sort of suggested there, it was more of a wake up, a smaller coffee moment for England and, you know, where they truly were in the world order of football, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, as you say, it was the opportunity to get to put things right after 1970. This was going to be England striding on and all of that. But, I mean, I think... What was I at the time? I was 8, so I probably didn't realise the wider context of it. But, I mean, when you look back into football history, this was very much a fault line for England. This was the start of that period where we were going to miss out on everything for the next 8 years until we got back into the Euros in 1980. Missed 2 World Cups, no real participation in the Euros in 1976 either. I mean, this was England going into the doldrums, really, and it was the beginning of the end for Sir Alf. And for the way that he played his football, and I think also now as you look back on it, it's the kind of the beginning of that dominance of European and of world football to a certain extent by West Germany and the Dutch. You may well disagree, Gary, but I mean this is a foreshadowing of total football in its way, the way West Germany played that night, and obviously Ajax at that point were winning the European Cups. Left, right, and centre. Bayern Munich would then take over for 3 years. So, I mean, this is the you know, the harbinger of what European football is going to be for the rest of the decade, really.
It's interesting. I mean, I remember the game, and I remember it was 3-1 defeat for England, and they drew 0-0 in the return Germany. It was pretty pointless, goalless and pointless, in fact. I can't remember the goals, but the enduring image of that game I have is Gunter Netzer sort of running through the England midfield with his blonde hair streaking behind him like some kind of David Duckham at rugby sort of thing. It just seemed to be, you know, have another gear, have another power that England hadn't gotten. It made the England midfield look sedentary, which they largely were, weren't they?
It really is interesting because, I mean, people talk about Alf Ramsey and he never managed to change from what he was and what he knew. And in this game, he does really, because there's no Alan Mullery, there's no Peter Storey, there's no sort of killer in the midfield that he had. I mean, he actually went 4-3-3. Rodney Marsh comes on in the second half with the England crowd baying for him. And it's just a disaster, really. It's a mishmash, you know. They don't come together. Now, I think it's always a big, we talk about Alf Ramsey and he didn't update the thing. We should have had the Mavericks and Stan Ball should have played every game and Rodney Marsh should have played and all of that. And I don't know. I mean, if you look at England's side in the World Cup in 66, it was full of world-class players, genuinely world-class players. You look at this West Germany team and you've got Sepp Maier in goal, you've got Franz Beckenbauer, you've got Gerd Müller up front, you've got Günter Netzer, you know, you've got Paul Breitner, you've got world-class players all over the place. England hadn't. You know, this is Jeff Hurst's final game for England. Bobby Moore's coming towards the end. It's a very different thing. And I mean, when I wrote my Alf Ramsey book, I took out a quote in between the two games. You know, England had to go out to Berlin to play the second leg, having lost 3-1. A bit of a pointless game, to be perfectly honest, as you mentioned. But there were, all the press was, you know, this is the time we change. This is when, you know, you bring in Rodney Marsh, you bring in all these footballers. And Helmut Schön said, he asked, I think it was Alan Hobley, who used to write for the Daily Express, do you think he'll change? Do you think he'll do what the press want him to? I hope so. We'll win by 6. Now, Helmut Schön knew what he was talking about. And I think that is, I mean, we've done the 70s series and we've done tributes to Stan Bowles recently and all that. And, of course, we're all besotted by these Mavericks, aren't we? Because they were fantastic. They were incredibly exciting. But they weren't world-class footballers at international level. That's the truth. Now, you can say they didn't get the opportunity, but they didn't get the opportunity because you couldn't rely on them. Nobody had more flair than Franz Beckenbauer or Johan Cruyff. But they delivered when it mattered. And that's what makes you a world-class footballer. It's not just what makes you an entertaining footballer. It makes you a world-class footballer that makes the difference on the big stage, on the big occasion, and wins your pots. And Rodney Marsh never did.
It's interesting you mentioned comparing this game to the Hungary game, and it never struck me before. But, you know, actually, it's a very sort of relevant point. I mean, you know, a Hungary in 53 destroyed England's veneer of invulnerability, and, you know, and which was, when you look back, was plain to see that it had been a sort of false image for a long time. And here, you know, when you go into 72, England had the World Cup defeat in 17. You could find lots of excuses for that. You know, Banks was absent in the heat and Bobby Charlton was sort of struggling in the heat and this sort of thing. And Germany had brought on two wingers and England hadn't refreshed the team. And it was almost like, you know, just trying to put a plaster on a broken leg, and that's not dealing with a problem. And I think this game was exposed that, you know, that really wasn't unfortunate. That was just a true telling of the story of where England were.
Absolutely. We didn't have players of the quality that we'd had 6 or 7 years before, 3 or 4 years before, even in Mexico. And that happens with, you know, it happens with all countries. No country manages to maintain that cycle forever. You look at Brazil, who probably had the most prolonged cycle, 58 to 70. That dried up for a period. The Dutch team that got to the finals in 74, 78, where were they in 82? Every team, West Germany, or the German team now, where's the German team been for the last, you know, since they won the World Cup in Brazil, where it happens, you go through cycles. And it's also very difficult for managers, particularly at international level, to change that team. This one we're looking at here, Bobby Moore, is still in there for England at 31, 32. Now, how do you replace Bobby Moore? And when do you drop Bobby Moore out? You know, all of a sudden, the time comes when Bobby Moore's finished. And the new fella, whoever he is, comes in and he's got to be Bobby Moore. He's played like 5 games for England because Bobby Moore's always been playing, you know. And in those days, there were fewer friendlies. Most of the games were important. So you don't get that chance to recycle a team in the way that a club manager might be able to. And let's face it, not many club managers are particularly good at it either. You know, they have their fallow periods as well. But I mean, it also speaks to of a completely different time, you know, 1972. The Football League played on Saturday. England played on Wednesday. Brian Clough wrote a sick note for Roy McFarland when he wasn't injured, but he didn't want him to play because Derby were going for the league title. Now, all of a sudden, Alf Ramsey on the Sunday morning, having picked his team, he's now going to replace Roy McFarland. And he replaces him with Norman Hunter, who's a fine player, but doesn't fit in the same way with Bobby Moore that Roy McFarland does. You know, so, I mean, it's a completely different landscape. Yeah, I think it's fascinating for all of that, but it's just a game where it's just brilliantly encapsulates the entire era. England actually equalise with about 10-15 minutes to go. Francis Lee picks one up in the 6-yard box, of Colin Bell shot that saved, and Francis Lee's there to tuck it away. And there's a little bit of a pitch invasion There's two lads. There's one with a long leather coat on, and flares like Noddy Holder, you know, and long flowing hair and all of that, you know. And that's the '70s. You got to think back to 66, just before Alf won the World Cup, and the cup final, Everton Sheffield Wednesday, and the fella runs onto the pitch at the cup final, and he's dressed in his suit and tie and all of that, and that's the distance England's travelled in those 7 years, and Alf hasn't travelled with it, and I think that's a big. It's a great piece of symbolism.
A classic metaphor moment there.
Yeah, absolutely it is. And yeah, there's the England crowd baying for Rodney Marsh, and Rodney Marsh comes on. The first thing he tries to do is fall over in the box and win a penalty, which is never a penalty in the world. And, you know, that's not Alf's way, is it?
No.
But Alf Ramsey, again, I was looking it up this morning. He was 52. He was 4 years younger than Jurgen Klopp is today. I mean, and yet he looks from a completely different world. It's
interesting. I mean, when you say that, he's 52. So in 66, he'd be mid-40s. I mean, you just think, he always looks 70, you know, didn't he? You know, and I guess when he said Martin Peters was a player, you know, 10 years ahead of his time, perhaps Ramsey was sort of 10 years behind his time, or perhaps 15 or 20 years.
By the time you get to the 70s, he is. But I think he's piloting a game that is not necessarily beyond the times, because, I mean, you know, obviously Liverpool go on to dominate the European Cup after Ajax and Bayern Munich have finished with it. So, you know, but in terms of international football, I just think that the way that England was set up at that period was set up to fail. Ultimately, it took another 10 years, I suppose, before we started taking it properly seriously away from the club game.
Sure. It's interesting you mentioned about Francis Lee scoring with 10 minutes left, I suppose, you know. Hope springs eternal, as it were. But so I guess the Germans scored two late goals from there.
Yeah, I think it's 78 minutes, I think, when Francis Lee scores. And then, of course, West Germany, having toyed with England throughout the game, they got the other end and scored twice. Gunter Netzer scores a penalty. And Gerd Müller, typical Gerd Müller goal, gets the ball with his back to goal, 14 yards out, turns, spears it into the bottom corner, which Gerd Müller spent 15 years doing all over the world. It was all catastrophe, as it always is in England when they're losing. The media was going berserk. No disgrace to lose to that West German team. That was a great West German team. They would go on and win the tournament. They'd go on and win the World Cup 2 years later, dripping with world class footballers all over the shop. You know, it's not a crime to be beaten by them, but it's just that it's a game that's just full of that symbolism. As you mentioned before, Gunter Netzer with the blonde hair flowing, he looks like he's about to audition for Deep Purple or something. You know, and he's running the game. He's absolutely running the game from midfield. And there's Rodney Marsh, can't get on the pitch. You know, who looks like Netzer's twin brother, can't get on the pitch. And that's all those fault lines are just there, beautifully sort of exposed.
Yeah. Gunter Netzer on one side, Alan Mulry and Peter Storey on the other. Doesn't suggest much ambition from England, does it? You mentioned you watched it live, Dave. So was it one of those sort of, I remember exactly where I was when I saw it situations, mate?
Yeah, sitting at home in the living room, as I said, just before my 8th birthday, I think it was. And it was such a rarity, you know, they clear the schedules on the Wednesday night on BBC One to put on football. You know, I don't think they did it the way they do now. I think it was like 5 minutes before kickoff they come on and there's a quick word in the studio and then the game and then off to the news straight after it's all finished. But you know, it was just I'm a great believer in scarcity value. You know, I think when something's scarce it becomes a lot more important and people pay a lot more attention to it. Sure. And that was what we had in those days. I mean, as you will remember, you got the FA Cup final, you get England versus Scotland. And very, very rarely you would get a big England game if it was a World Cup qualifier or a European qualifier like this one that really mattered. I mean, the run-of-the-mill group games you would never get live on television. So it was, you had to watch it. You absolutely had to watch it. And obviously it would be after school, wouldn't it? You know, come home after school, sit down, have your tea, get ready for this fantastic game and then watch England getting absolutely mothered by mother.
It's fascinating you say that, you know, and people, you know, the, you know, people who were sort of in the 20s or so can't imagine the difference between what you've just described and the wall-to-wall. I mean, almost literally 27 channels of football and internet and all this sort of thing. You know, can't imagine the difference between the football coverage in those days, 72. So we're talking just a dab over 50 years of difference. I mean, it sounds a long time, but the change is probably, you know, a more than that times 5 decades would suggest, perhaps.
I think so. I mean, obviously, it's post-Premier League, isn't it? That sort of exploded into real masses of live football. And then, obviously, now the internet and streaming and all of that kind of stuff. I mean, all the games. You can watch virtually anything you want, can't you? Wherever you like. I don't know. It's an old-fashioned view, and anybody in their 20s listening to this will think I'm mad, but, I mean, it added to it when you couldn't get much of it.
You're right. You're absolutely right, yeah. You're absolutely right. You know, I was going to say England have had a checkered history in the European Championship, but that'd be flattering them too much. I mean, they've had a pretty bleak history in the. But you've sort of you've chosen for your memory a fairly sobering performance for England, or sobering sort of match that England participated. Why did you select this one, mate?
Well, I mean, I think partly because of what you've just been saying. You know, the fact that it was such a rarity. You know, to see this live game on football made such a big impression. So that's a big part of it. And as I say again, that fault line. This is where the glories of 66, and to an extent, the 70 was a bit of glory. In effect, I mean, they played that fantastic game against Brazil.
Yeah,
it was a hard luck story of sorts against West Germany. So I mean, we were still basking in a little bit of that. This was the dream is over kind of thing. And then that started a process. I suppose it was another 10 years before England were really a power of any sort in world football again. You know, you go to Spain in 82 and do tolerably well, I suppose. So, I mean, it's that big fault line. And historically, I think it's important. And, you know, I just think it's part of such a big picture. It tells a big story. It's not just you could talk about Van Basten's goal in 88 for hours, couldn't you, or something like that. But I think this tells it's an element in a big wide story, and this is the key turning point, I think.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I was going to ask sort of when I'm talking to people about the memories of this, what was it significant for the moment and perhaps also for later? But I think there's very little doubt that this was a real signal moment for England, you know, and its significance was very much that it pointed out the reality of where England were rather than where they thought or hoped they were.
It did, and nobody had an answer, to be perfectly honest. I mean, you know, obviously I've carried on then for the next couple of years and failed to qualify for the World Cup in 74, which was less of a failure than it looks, because obviously Poland were a great side. We were in a three-team group, and as Poland proved in West Germany in 74, you know, and going on to finish in third place, they were a great side. Again, different times, a different World Cup with 16 countries in it, as opposed to the 140 that we're heading towards in the near future. But after it went to Don Revie. Now, I don't think anybody necessarily argued with Don Revie. It was him or Brian Clough, I suppose, whatever your view was, and England still couldn't get it right. And you know, I think it said a lot about how club football was far more important, certainly at that period, than international football. Although international football is the thing that got the big audiences, on the rare occasions it was on television, people really cared about their club, and certainly the Football League was doing nothing to help England at all. I mean, yeah. Here we are playing West Germany, and we're not going to cancel the Saturday's fixtures or anything like that. You know, everybody's going to play through it 3 or 4 weeks before the end of the season. So every game means something. It's a relegation game. It's a championship game. It's a European, you know, qualify for Europe game. Yeah, well, we'll go through all the muck and bullets of that, and then if anybody's still standing, they can play for England on Wednesday night.
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating. But, I mean, just hearing you talk, there two things come to mind. Firstly, you know, the lack of primacy given to the national team in those days, and I remember, you know, the old story about Alex Ferguson having the medical certificate in his thing. He could sign. Ryan Giggs has got a thigh strain and can't play for in the Wales friendly against Malawi or somebody. The second thing is that, you know, even, you know, I guess 12 months down the road, the arrogance is, you know, of sort of supported or sort of trumpeted by the press when they played Poland was still very much, you know, the classics has been Brian Clough calling Tomaszewski a clown, and we was, oh, of course we'll roll these over, and you know, ignoring the pedigree of the team facing, very much as they did, you know, in Germany, you know, and Poland had a wonderful pedigree of, you know, Olympic success before the tournament and after as well, the World Cup, and were probably unlucky not to get to the final. They played West Germany in that swamp of a game that was sort of the Dutch against the Poles would have been a fantastic final, but that arrogance still persisted a little bit, didn't it? Sort of, you know, but this was very much a sort of a kicking it down the sort of slippery slope, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah. I mean, that arrogance, I mean, we always have that arrogance, don't we, about football's coming home, which we'll come on to perhaps, but that's another story.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, I think that is part of the English attitude to football. It's our game. We gave the game to the world. Therefore, we are, you know, yeah, well, unfortunately, the world caught on to that game quite quickly and overtook us in many situations. This is, but it, you know, I mean, for people of our age as well, the optics of it, it's a full Wembley Stadium, the proper Wembley Stadium, yeah, which is, you know, the new Wembley Stadium's fine and all that. It ain't Wembley. Yeah, you know, Wembley's got the Twin Towers and all of that stuff. And the, you know, the bowl and the walk, the long walk out from the yeah, tunnel in the middle of the pitch and all that sort of stuff. So for, you know, for people of our age, this is proper Wembley. It's in the floodlights. It's in the murk. Everything about it is right for, you know, for me, for choosing it as the game, you know, that I remember probably best of anything in the, you know. Also, as you get to my age, you can remember the 1970s far better than you can remember 5 years ago. So
I'm right with you there, buddy. Okay, so just moving forward, turning our perspective into the summer of 2024 rather than 72, what do the Euros mean to you, mate, and contemporary times?
It's interesting. I mean, again, I don't know if you'll agree with me, but growing up, they were very much the ugly sister, weren't they? You know, there wasn't a huge amount of interest in there. Perhaps that's partly because England were such a failure at them for such a long period of time. But I think very often you would, even in the media, you would be saying, well, perhaps the England manager over the next 2 years in these Euros should be experimenting so that he's got his team right for when the World Cup comes along. And then that I think that sort of persisted probably into Bobby Robson's time, really. It was seen as very much the second-rate tournament. And I think from an English perspective, Euro 96 changed that massively. Probably the 88 Euros as well, you know, the Dutch win and all that iconic stuff, Van Basten's goal and Ruud Gullit and all of that, that sort of accelerated. But, I mean, you know, you go back 4 years before that, we didn't even screen the 1984 Euros over here, oddly, because none of the home nations had qualified, so we couldn't be bothered. You know, and that was how it was then. It's become a much more important thing. I think like the World Cup, it's suffered because it's got too many teams in it. It's very difficult not to qualify for the knockout stages, although Scotland will probably find a way to do it, as they always do. I hope they do better and do well. But you get to these bloated tournaments and you do sort of wonder, well, what's the first 2 weeks for? And then it gets exciting, and then it gets interesting. But it's a much more important tournament now than it was, certainly when I'm talking about 1972. It was real significant. Now, I mean, again, maybe that's partly because we're England and we don't really care about these Europeans, you know. And, you know, let's face it, we didn't get the World Cup till 1950, you know. So why would we care about the Euros, my God? You know, I think it says a lot about us that we didn't really pay much attention to it. Thankfully, that's changed, and thankfully it's become a far more important tournament now. And obviously, you know, looking forward now to what's going to come in the summer. But hey, it was very much the you know, the second right thing back in the 70s, I'd say.
Yeah. Okay. So here's the sort of, before we close, here's the sort of million-dollar question: who's going to win?
It's very difficult to look beyond France. I think they, you know, we've seen tournaments over the last, what, 6 years, haven't we? How great the French are. I think Mbappe is the best tournament goal scorer, best tournament striker that there is. So I think it's very difficult to see past that. If England are ever going to win anything ever again, this is as good a chance as they're going to get. They've got a decent run at it this time. It seems peculiar to be having a tournament in Germany and not be talking about the Germans, but I mean, they've just seemed so far away from things at the last, you know, the last World Cup and the last few tournaments. There again, you know, 2006, they got all the way to the semi-finals of the World Cup, didn't they? Coming from virtually nowhere. So, you know, you've got to expect that Germany will put up a fight. But if I had to put some money in it, I'd go with France, I think.
It's interesting, Dave, you know, Hope Springs Eternal map, you know, we're talking about memories from 72, where England were sort of pointed to the exit door, as it were, rather abruptly. But Hope Springs Eternal, we still think they've got a chance this time, mate. So you've got to believe so. I mean, players like, you know, Bellingham, you know, who knows? Kane scoring goals in Germany, so he knows where the back of the German nets are. So perhaps there's a chance.
If it's ever going to happen, this is as good an opportunity as any, I think. Because I just think, you know, you look to the next World Cup, I think it's very difficult to go and win that World Cup, you know, where it is with the schedule that you're going to have. I think that's very, very difficult to see a European team winning that one. So this is the opportunity, I think, for this generation of players.
You're certainly going to do a lot of travelling in the next World Cup, that's for sure. Well, many thanks, Dave. Thanks for sharing that memory with us. Well, that completes this stroll down memory lane. With many thanks to Dave for sharing his thoughts with us. So catch us again next time when I'll be chatting with another member of the TFT team about their recollections of the European Championships. Cheers. Bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.